The world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest this week is Alan Clark, the author of the book Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior. Alan served in Vietnam. He was very seriously wounded while there in the United States Army. He's a graduate of the Military Academy at West Point. Lost both legs in his service in Vietnam and has traveled a remarkable road ever since then, leading eventually through great turmoil and trauma to great success. And it's a pleasure and honor, Alan, to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Gene. It's my privilege and pleasure to be here with you.
You're one of the rare people that I know, because I count myself among them, that it may not have been age 8, but I always knew what I wanted to do from an early age, and you always wanted to be a soldier.
I always did. You know, I was in Japan with my father, who was in the Army of Occupation at age 8, when the communists came across the 38th parallel, and all the troops got on the trains. We used to go see them off, and I'd hear them talking when they came back, and Dad's best friend was killed at the Chosin Reservoir, and that's all that I ever wanted to be.
And you used to hang out outside the PX and try to, even you had your pocket knife with you to get some combat badges off people or regimental badges.
I was an aggressive patch collector. They never would obviously be carrying an extra patch. When a soldier would come out of there from all the Allied forces, we had about 16 countries involved on our side, I'd see a patch I didn't have in my collection. I'd ask them if they had an extra, and naturally they didn't. And I said, well, I have a pocket knife. And amazingly enough, some of those wonderful young men cut their patch off for me.
And you wanted to go to West Point all the time?
All the time. Well, you know, probably very shortly after that, in my patch collection, I came up with a West Point patch and asked Dad about it, and he began to tell me about it, that it trained officers for the Army. And I said, well, that sounds like that's something that I ought to consider doing. So it was a very young age when I was dedicated, had a goal, and began studying very earnestly.
But one of the themes of your book is providential intervention, almost, and you make the point early on that there was that kind of intervention, in fact, in terms of your getting into the academy, even.
Oh, yes, I think so. There's always been, I believe, the good Lord watching over me and blessing my life. I mean, I have attempted to merit the favor, as we call it, grace, unmerited favor, and I have had that many times. Originally didn't have the good enough eyesight to go to the academy. And as I recollect, you know, sometimes we forget how things really happened and have an impression, but that the eye standards were lowered the year that I needed to get in. And also having the congressman give me a principal nomination, and he was going to be a lame duck congressman. It was his last year, so I went in earlier than normal.
Well, earlier is an understatement. I mean, you didn't even finish high school, and you still went to West Point.
Well, the congressman called me on Christmas Eve, said, Alan, I have a principal nomination. I said, Congressman, I don't want it till next year. He said, Alan, I'm a lame duck congressman. He says, why don't you take the exams, and if you pass, decide whether to go in early, and then if you don't pass, you've got experience for the next year. And so Dad was an attorney, a licensed attorney in the Army, and he checked the regs, and the regulations said that a West Point cadet should be a high school graduate. Didn't say had to be, and there's a big difference. So I entered as the youngest man in my class of 1963.
You may have been one of the youngest entrants in a long time, as a matter of fact.
Well, possibly.
When you got there, did it meet the expectations you had for so many years?
Well, you know, you never can know what to expect as a cadet or a midshipman at the service academies. I've always said in my speeches that West Point's a good place to be from, but not at. And I definitely didn't appreciate being at there as a plebe in Beast Barracks. My father had been transferred to Hawaii, and I had these these impressions of surfboarding and, you know, going out to the University of Hawaii or something and going to finish my senior year. And so that was tough on me. And candidly, I was just about ready to resign as a Beast Barracks plebe.
Mm-hmm.
Decided not to because of the involvement and one of those providential things that a first classman named Nicky Rowe, who came to be a celebrated hero of this country, was my company commander. And providentially, his mother had known my mother with, you know, 760 new cadets and all these upperclassmen. He'd known my mother. They had known each other from McAllen, Texas, in the lower Rio Grande Valley. And so it was a personalized approach there by Nick to ask me to consider staying in, that things got better with the academic year. And they did.
Mm-hmm. So then you graduated, you're commissioned, and off you go, and then you get married.
Yes, and the first wife was a wonderful woman, just as is my current wife, Linda, and that tells you that we didn't make it. She really wanted to go back to North Dallas. She'd been an SMU, Southern Methodist University graduate, and liked the stable life without moving and the maneuvers and the interruptions in the service, and definitely the specter of Vietnam at that time in 64, 65, reared its ugly head, and she wanted me to resign. And I had a real agonizing decision to make, to preserve my marriage or to go forward with the career I'd always wanted to have.
Mm-hmm. You didn't have to go to Vietnam.
No, I...
Why did you?
Well, I had the opportunity to be a general's aide and go to Korea, which would have been an unaccompanied tour. And my wife wanted me to resign. I decided to resign. I could have gone to Korea, gotten my unaccompanied tour out of the way, come back and been out of the military, supposedly, and not go to Nam. But the Vietnam War was the defining time for all of us regular Army people, much less dedicated patriots in the military at the time. And I never felt that I could not go to the war, resign, and go to classmate reunions at West Point or see my classmates if I got out of going to the war. So I secretly, to her, volunteered for Vietnam. And obviously, when you volunteer during a war, you typically go. And I did go.
And you volunteered for a rather extraordinary assignment.
Well, in Vietnam, you know, you're kind of accustomed to talking to people on airplanes that sit next to you. Well, one time going from Saigon into Trang, I talked to a lieutenant colonel who was a special forces commander of the special forces in the Central Highlands, and he told me he needed an S2 officer at one of his B teams. So I said, well, maybe I can transfer in country. It happened very quickly, transferred in, didn't get my assignment to go up there. And after about a week, I went to this real grizzled old master sergeant and said, what's going on? Why haven't I been assigned there and moved out? And he says, you've been reassigned to a covert operation. And so I had to find out about that, find out it was espionage against Cambodia. It was Detachment B-57 Army Special Forces. We had a unilateral operation, meaning with no help from the South Vietnamese forces, so only we knew about it, to collect intelligence out of Cambodia when it was a privileged sanctuary still.
Well, you even had to get a new identity and a new name, right?
I did. I started out in the assignment just basically setting up the unit. I was the first officer assigned to it, to my recollection. And then I debriefed a Cambodian officer who had defected to the United States for a month. And he was later supposedly killed by my replacement in my unit after I'd left the country. And then I worked with three Cambodian young men to be dropped off next to the border to go in through the jungle. Two dropped out after that mission. They said it's too dangerous, so I took one and one more, trained them, set them up against the border, and then my CO, commanding officer, sent me to Dok To Special Forces Camp beginning in March of 67. And I was there up until June 17th, 1967.
Well, tell us what happened in June 1967 in Dok To.
Well, special forces camps are always out in the boondocks. I mean, you know, it's the original Indian country of the old cavalry post era in our West, in our history. And special forces camps are very isolated. The whole idea is to have 12 or so Americans that go out in very isolated areas to help provide some kind of security to the local villagers and the Montagnards and so forth. So we had this camp there. We were sending out patrols. I was in the camp recruiting Montagnards to go back into Cambodia. So I was running intelligence nets under false name, infantry brass, and another name, a false name named Copley. And the NVA, North Vietnamese Army troops, decided that they would take our camp. And so they started moving toward our camp, two ambushes nearby, about 5 miles away. And then the evening of the 16th, we saw some activity across the river. And as it was, we thought they were just villagers from the nearby area, so we didn't call a strike in on it. And the next morning at 4:30, a mortar attack started. My commanding officer did not want me to be there and take the chance on being captured because I knew a lot. I'd started the unit. I knew everybody in the unit. I knew where we all were. And so the enemy always gets it out of you when they capture you, of course, through torture. And so he was going to pick me up at 9:30. So I was 5 hours away from, quote, freedom and security to be out of the camp. I felt a little bit guilty about that, but the 173rd was going to come in and fight the enemy. So I said, okay, well, I'll go because, you know, nothing's going to be happening here anyway. So I'm on the shift at 4:30 when a heavy, heavy mortar barrage started in the camp.
And?
Well, keep moving along with the story here. You know, I was an American on duty between 4 and 6. And
so you got hit.
I got hit. Mortar round dropped probably a foot and a half to my left rear. And I fell forward. I yelled out, "Oh, God, I'm dead." We just visited. My wife and I just visited some Marines down at Camp Allen at Norfolk. And the Marine captain commander there was talking about, everybody yells out for God or Mama, and I yelled out, "Oh God, I'm dead!" and just defined that I thought I was dead. Two very, very brave Army Special Forces sergeants came out from undercover and took me downstairs in a litter. Sergeant Jimmy Hill, Army Special Forces combat medic, with whom I'm still in contact, and is an interesting part of my life, how we had closure a couple of years ago, and that saved me by getting morphine and plasma for me and began to treat me before the medevac.
Well, we're going to pause right there, and we'll come back and continue this fascinating story with Alan Clark, the author of Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior, after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell. We're talking this week with Alan Clark, the author of Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior. And Alan, when we paused for the break, you had been seriously injured. You didn't know the extent of it yourself at the time. As you said, the medics got to you, and you eventually got out and were taken to a field hospital and finally made your way back to the United States. There was a period of time there, and I want to spend a little bit of time here on it, because this brings your parents into the picture, your sister into the picture, your first wife into the picture. And let me just say here that one of the things that I found very interesting about the book is the way it's formatted, in that they tell in their own words what their reaction was to certain events at certain times. And the notification comes back, and your father, I guess, is the first person to get a telegram, and he knows immediately that it has to do with you, because he doesn't get telegrams addressed to Colonel Clark any longer. And why did you decide to bring these people into the book in that way? Was that your idea? Was that your editor's idea? What?
No, it was always my own idea. My editor for this publication, Zenith Press in St. Paul, Minnesota, did not get into this picture until a year ago. I began writing these stories right after the war in social meetings with my friends, and beginning in the early 70s after I went to graduate school and started my job. I would begin telling them stories about the covert operations, about the Montagnards, about special forces. They said, oh, these are very interesting, Alan. You ought to write them up and do a book someday. Well, I began to be flattered enough that I continued to add to the stories, and then I had some political involvement and all. But those letters I found, they had been sent to me, and then I also asked them in the early 70s to, I said, I think I may begin writing this story, so I need your firsthand recollections now while it's still fresh on your mind. So I began to collect those anecdotes, and knew that I wanted to hear what they had to say. So I began to put those together as I began to live the story of my life and add new chapters.
Well, it makes for a very interesting
book
and moves it along in a very interesting fashion.
Thank you.
When you got back, how long was it before you understood the extent of your injuries, and what was your frame of mind at that time?
Well, I was wounded on Saturday morning, and Sunday night I woke up. I mean, I'm under heavy morphine. I have intravenous in both arms, but I had no toes under the sheet on the left side, so I knew very quickly that left leg was gone. The right leg was in a hip cast, all the way from my hip all the way down to my toes. My right toes were all black and blue, but I could see them. And so I knew very quickly that I'd obviously had a very severe injury. But I was so drugged out that in a state of euphoria, that and so close to the wound and just off the battlefield at the hospital in Pleiku, that you don't recognize or realize the impact of what's happened to you. You slowly grasp it as you get further away from it. I was able to come back to the United States very quickly. And at Brooke General Hospital, I'd been back 3 days after a week off the battlefield. In other words, 10 days after the wound, they took my right leg off. And it was very, very painful for me. The morphine only I would give it a shot of morphine only every 3 hours. And, I mean, it started to wear off at about the two-hour mark. And, I mean, you just beg the nurses. And they'd say, 3 hours. Captain, you wait for your 3 hours, period, So it was really brutal. And I began to have, I began to have nightmares very quickly. We had on the July 4th down there, they had some fireworks display. And, I thought we came under attack down at Brooke General Hospital. Those are some of the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The triggers from the battlefield and the war and the wounds and so forth begin to bother us. So I began an 8-month period there of a total 15-month period where I had to start seeing a psychiatrist. And, my family was involved, and especially my first wife, Jackie, was involved to help me begin to build my confidence, which was not building during those 8 months at all.
Well, I'm sure of that, but you also had, which brings us to a contemporary point, as a matter of fact, about the controversy of Walter Reed. You also had some very excellent and loving care from the staff at Brooke.
Yes, I did. I have no complaints. I mean, if there was bad medical care or not the best, I don't know anything about it. Our doctors and our nurses and our staff people worked very, very hard there in a dedicated fashion. I had no complaints. And I really think that much of this is overblown at Walter Reed and the Veterans Hospital today. I believe that the medical care per se is extraordinary in the Army hospitals and the Naval Medical Centers. The people are dedicated, and this was an off-the-post type of a place that we were responsible for, the Army was responsible for, but it was an administrative issue that has a lot to do with budget and with maintenance and with having, a Sergeant E7 inspect that building every day, and that was his assignment.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. The articles that the Post originally ran concentrated only on the negatives at one place and you wouldn't know that there was some of the best medical care in the world being provided at Walter Reed.
Exactly.
And I know people personally who are there who are receiving it. So we're going to get you, when we come back after this break, back into civilian mode, if you will, and learn about what happened to you after your military career. And there's a whole lot to talk about. And then get to how you healed not just your body, but your soul. And we'll be back with Alan Clark, author of Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior, in a moment after this break.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiaxin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest space.
Cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week with Alan Clark, the author of Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior. Alan, we've got you in the hospital. You're undergoing all kinds of physical and otherwise rehab. But the psychological and psychiatric aspects of recovery are something I'd like to get into and have you talk about a little bit.
Well, as I mentioned to you, that things were going relatively well. I had to begin building my confidence. I had bone grafts, skin grafts. They kept picking out little pieces of shrapnel from my leg. And it's a very painful process because they don't dope you up for that. And they go in and they debride you, as it's called, and pull out the little pieces down at the bottom where you have your open wounds till they close them off. And then you begin walking on legs. I began to be very scared. I began to be very, very worried about walking, having children. What was I going to do with the rest of my life? I mean, you know, here I was. I had my 30-year career planned out and everything was messed up. I was going to be divorcing and that was bad enough. But then to not have legs, to be 4'6" and to be scared, I went without sleep for 4 days. And I promise you, anybody will crack with 4 days without sleep. I did, and I was very aggressive, and I was very angry. I was bitter, and I had to go to a closed psychiatric ward for 14 weeks at Brooke General Hospital. Horrible time of my life. Individual psychotherapy, lots of pills, group therapy, and everything till I eventually worked my way out of there. And then about 3 months after that, I was able to leave the Army. But I was angry at God. I was angry at the world. I was angry at the Army. And I mean, just angry that my life had taken such a topsy-turvy turn and that I was hurt so badly, you know, mentally, emotionally, and physically, and spiritually.
Well, spiritually, let's talk about that a minute, because this is a predominant theme in your book, it seems to me, is the role that your religion and your faith has played in not only your recovery, but your entire life, because you're very much dedicated to promulgating the message right now yourself. But you didn't come to this early.
Well, you know, in my faith as a Christian, there are plateaus of your faith and you're growing and you're building, just like in the career fields that you have with more education and so forth. I believed in Jesus Christ as Savior as a teenager. I was very active in a church in Alexandria, Virginia. But I really hadn't started that faith walk that I call where Jesus became Lord of my life. And that really didn't start until age 31. You know, about the time that I stopped my psychotherapy, I had pills and saw a psychiatrist till age 73. almost concurrently with the time when I went to a service and realized and grasped the ultimate eternal struggle as defined by a sermon that I heard from Pastor Gene Getz. The ultimate eternal struggle of the war of the world is good versus evil, God versus the devil. And I'd been in a little bitty skirmish out there with freedom in man's world, but I really wasn't in the larger battle, war of the world and war of all time since recorded history from the Garden of Eden. And that's when I began to get into the Bible, get into my prayers, learning the power of prayer, how God answers prayer, not always the way we want to, but the way He wants us by His will. And I began to progress in my faith in the 70s and into the 80s and into now, and was able to get away from the elements and symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, the majority of them, by that faith walk. And, you know, today, I am working very hard in lay ministry and programs and speeches and so forth to talk about what happened to me and my healing and my faith walk, and to be able to tell people about that so they can have the opportunity to heal the way I did.
Mm-hmm. Well, prior to that walk beginning in earnest, you've had a few other journeys as well. You dabbled in politics, and you served in Washington, you had your eyes opened about the way politics works, as I recall from reading your book, right?
That's true. Well, I think an interesting aspect of my history, and it relates to politics, of someone that ran for president twice, is Ross Perot, who's written the foreword for my book, a wonderful foreword. I had gone to work for him in 1970, and I worked very hard. I was dedicated. I was his personal financial assistant, had a lot of responsibility very quickly. I felt that I did, and I cracked again in 1970 when I was working for him.
Well, it was too much too soon.
Yes, the psychiatrist said, go to an easy job. So what do? I go to work for the most well-known entrepreneur in the country at the time, and very well-known, eventually ran for office, as I indicated. So that didn't work. So I went to work at a bank where they, basically closed everything down by about 5 o'clock, and was there, but began to get involved in politics. And it was kind of another way for me to express myself and do service to my fellow people in the country as a citizen. I couldn't do it in the military, but so I began to do it in politics. And, I became a special assistant for administration to Texas Governor Bill Clements, who was elected in 1978, the first Republican since Reconstruction in Texas, and was on his staff for 2.5 years, and then had an abortive stay up here as President Reagan's selectee to be the number two man at the Veterans Administration before it became a cabinet. And I had a political buzzsaw with the number one person there, and didn't really want to do
that.
Well,
let me just interrupt you to say that one of the things I admired most about the book was the fact that you, in effect, told him to shove it, because realized early on that it was not going to be a match, it was not going to be a fit, and the person who took the job discovered that after a few months.
Yes. Well, the one that replaced me was Chuck Hagel, who's now United States Senator.
Right.
He lasted 6 months, and the number three man had the same problem for a short period of time, Ev Alvarez, who's been interviewed on your program and has become a friend of mine through the years. So I pegged this man who was picked and nominated and confirmed at the time, but he didn't last very long. He lasted 17 months. But I learned a lot from that. And
But you eventually did go back to the department and serve in a high-level position.
Yes, I did. I came back in 89, but I had another little detour in politics. When I came back, I went to work for an oil man in Texas in 81 when the opportunity up here didn't work, and I had a very interesting lunch with the current president out in Midland, Texas, in the oil business, and then I ran for, right after I left his office, Governor Clements, in June 1982, called me to run for state treasurer against Ann Richards, which was an interesting race, to say the least. I was a late admittee to that race, interesting case, but got out of that, came to work for President George H.W. Bush, and I was an assistant secretary at the Department of Veterans Affairs, and eventually ran the cemetery system.
Well, that must have been an interesting assignment.
both of them were just fascinating jobs. To be able to come to Washington and be at the Department of Veterans Affairs and to be working as an Assistant Secretary of Veterans Liaison and Program Coordination, I was able to be the interface between the Secretary and all the major veterans organizations. And I traveled a lot. I met some wonderful heroes and great men and women that have served this country, the families that have supported the men and women that have served this country. And it was an absolutely fantastic opportunity. And then we had 115 cemeteries, and I traveled the country, visited in 18 months, 85 of those 115 cemeteries, and met our people. And that was probably one of the best jobs I'll ever have in my life. It was a privilege to have that responsibility with the government.
Two things I want to get to. We talked about, or you've mentioned, post-traumatic stress problems. At the time when you were experiencing the first symptoms of this, it was not even a term, almost, that appeared anywhere. Yeah. And there was no recognition of the fact that this was an inevitable follow-on after going through what kinds of war experiences some people did. How do you feel about that now?
Well, post-traumatic stress disorder has an interesting history. Civil War is called condition of the heart. World War I, it was called battle shock. World War II, it began to be battle fatigue in Korean War. When we first got back, it was just kind of like old-timey definitions and terms to it. Until 1980, when they set up the vet centers, did they really start to run about that time? Did they really begin to understand that people coming back from war are not only physically hurt, but they're also mentally and emotionally and spiritually hurt? And that began to be termed by the psychiatrists, I guess, the medical fraternity in the country, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder. So we veterans from Vietnam, sometimes carry that with a degree of pride, which, you know, is kind of a mixed emotion, but we have it, and really people from World War II now define it as that, but all periods of warfare have it. And I have done extensive study on this, and I have had it myself. I have been healed from the majority of the symptoms, and I have a lay ministry website called Combat Faith that I have done extensive work on, going back to all wars and anecdotes from all the wars on there, my own PTSD story, and I have a segment there which is called The Symptoms of Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, the major issues and elements that we reflect as combat veterans and how they impact us and how they impact their families. So it's a site that people, that if they have somebody they think has it, or they think they have it themselves as a warrior, to go to it and try to get some help and relief from the spiritual and faith-based angle, because the pills that are thrown at us and the group therapy and the psychotherapy can only take you so far. The real ultimate comfort and relief from all of this, although you can get it from those sources, the way that it's worked for me is through my faith in the Lord Jesus. And I have put what I've learned on there and what I hope can help others at that combatfaith.com website.
Why do you think there are still people out there trying to debunk this whole business?
Well, I think that part of it is they have no earthly idea what it is to be under fire in combat. They have no earthly idea what it is to a medic who has the guilt complex because he couldn't save everybody. I have talked to dozens, if not hundreds, of veterans through the years. And so the combat medic, having saved lives, doesn't look at it that he saved those lives. He feels guilty those he didn't save. The combat person there, the company commander that lost his radio operator right next to him from a sniper, he has the fear from that. He has the anguish and the memories of those things. The people in combat that come under an ambush attack. And that's something only on the ground that the Marines and the Navy corpsmen and the Marines and the Army suffer. The people that are flying over may have a certain amount of stressors, and I understand, you know, getting fired on and all that, and on the ships and all, but there's nothing like that ground combat in close proximity to the enemy and having the weapons being fired very nearby and the grenades going off and the mortar rounds coming off and the stressors of that. There's nothing like that. Unless you've been there and done that, you can't make a judgment on it, that it's not a real and positive thing. It's a real and positive thing. I know it from the people I've talked to.
Mm-hmm. In addition to the website you mentioned a minute ago, what other things are you doing with this new venture of yours?
Well, my Combat Faith ministry, the book is really a part of my ministry. Having the book out there telling the story, the wounded soldier is a story about my war story. The healing warrior is about me being a warrior in the spiritual arena, trying to help others heal.
Well, let me ask you about that.
Yeah.
Pardon me. Because
yeah.
I was surprised that the title wasn't juxtaposed,
yeah.
That it might well have been Wounded Warrior, Healing Soldier.
Yeah,
why?
Well, I don't pretend to be a warrior. I mean, I was a Army Intelligence Service officer, considered military intelligence today. I was not an infantryman. I mean, I went out in harm's way, to say the least, in a special forces camp and what I did. But I don't consider myself a warrior like these people that are airborne ranger, paratroopers, special operations, infantry in the ground, and so forth. I was a staff officer that happened to get caught in a mortar attack. So the wounded soldier is my being wounded, but I'm healed, basically. I mean, I walk on these artificial legs, and I've gotten taller on my legs, and I tell that story in the book, you know, going from 5'8" to 6'2". So I've healed medically. I will always have a certain element of me that's not totally healed, but I've done a pretty good job of restoring myself and coming back. And the healing warrior is to be a warrior in the spiritual arena to help my fellow real warriors heal from the battles of the battlefield.
When I interrupted you, you were talking about how, in addition to the book, you are moving this forward.
Well, the book, you know, I have a segment in there toward the end called Battle Plan for Victory, which is a way that anybody, not just veterans, can look at that and say, oh, yeah, it would help straighten my life out if I forgave others, if I wasn't bitter, if I wasn't angry, if I got my relationship straight, if I forgave myself for mistakes. Because the major issues on post-traumatic stress disorder are we made mistakes, other people made mistakes, we have to forgive them. Same thing in life. It drives us in life, whether we're veterans or not, into substance abuse and into multiple marriages. So this is a way to help heal. I also do a lot of public speaking. I go to churches. I go to seminars. I go to retreats. I go to, like I just came back from the military ministry of Campus Crusade for Christ and gave a presentation on my post-traumatic stress disorder and how I've been healed. So the combination of the book, the website, and my own personal speaking engagements are the essence of what reflects me today as a healing warrior in the spiritual arena.
So as you look back on it, do you have any regret that you, from the age 8, wanted to go to West Point?
No, I was interviewed the other day for a television program that's going to be coming up on July 4th, and I said at the end, I am very proud to be a soldier of the United States of America.
Well, thank you for your service, and thank you for being here today. Thank you for what you continue to do for the men and women who are still serving.
It's a privilege to help my fellow veterans and live my life again.
We've been talking with Alan Clark, the author of Wounded Soldier, Healing Warrior. And we'll return with our weekly World War II Chronicles and our salute to an American military hero.
To learn more about this program or the American Veterans Center, call 202-777-7272 or log on to AmericanVeteransCenter.org.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.AmericanVeteransCenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
Welcome to Profiles in Valor, stories of decorated men and women serving in today's military.
Our guest today is Specialist David R. Hutchinson, United States Army Reserve. On June 6, 2009, the 65th anniversary of D-Day, Specialist Hutchinson became only the 5th Army Reserve soldier to receive the Silver Star. His actions in Afghanistan on May 21, 2008 were directly responsible for saving the lives of 16 of his fellow soldiers. Specialist Hutchinson, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit, if you could, about your job with the 420th Engineer Brigade while deployed to Afghanistan. When exactly did you begin your deployment?
I began deployment the same month the incident happened, so it was May of 2008. I was only actually in country for 5 days when this happened. I wasn't in country very long.
5 days after you began there, and that's when the action happens. You didn't have a whole lot of time to get acclimated to Afghanistan then.
No, not really.
No. Well, if you could then take us your fifth day in, take us back to the morning of May 21st, 2008, and tell us a little bit about what happened.
Okay, I was a member of a security detail. 16 or 17 members in the security detail. We were going out to basically get acquainted with our surroundings. There were a couple fobs that we were going to be traveling to in the future, so we wanted to get acquainted with the roads and what it was like to travel on those roads. It was only supposed to be a three-hour convoy, 3 hours out and then 3 hours back. We were about an hour and a half, hour 45 minutes into the convoy when we came into a small mountain pass or valley. And about the time all four trucks got into that small pass is when the first gun truck started opening up fire with his 50 cal machine gun. At that point, I couldn't see what was going on. I could just hear the front truck firing. It wasn't 3 or 4 seconds later when I saw several insurgents pop up on the ridge to my, basically in front of me, but to the right of the convoy. They immediately started opening fire on all the trucks with machine guns, AK-47s, rocket propelled grenades, and about two and a half, three minutes into the firefight, our truck was finally struck by two RPGs. Those RPGs, the blast knocked me out of my turret and laid me flat inside the truck. At that point, it left me numb from my waist down.
So the fighters, they were there. They were ready for you, obviously. Was this your first engagement in Afghanistan?
Yes, it was first engagement in Afghanistan.
And was this expected around where you were at, or did this come as a complete surprise?
It was definitely a complete surprise. The area we were in was, from what we were told, was pretty calm for the past 12 months, so we weren't expecting anything. But I mean, we were expecting, but we weren't expecting anything.
Right, right. I understand. So you're in the third gun truck, manning the MK-19. And the attackers taking the initiative came after you. When they came out of their protected positions and came out of the open, how did you really react to that?
It was very surprising to me that they were very determined for them to come out from. I mean, I wasn't just seeing muzzle flashes. I could make out entire torsos from the waist up. From where they were at, it was very surprising to me that they were that determined to take out our convoy.
And so you began taking advantage of the situation, didn't you, and began really firing at their strongest position, correct?
Correct.
And from what I understand, that you were so effective with your fire that they really turned their attention pretty much squarely on you, right? And I read that members of your unit later counted over 100 bullet strikes on your turret.
Yep, well over 100. And then there were a couple that were actually inside the turret with me too.
Wow, I would imagine that would be a what was going on through your minds, if anything, or were you just pretty much concentrated on doing your job?
I was completely concentrated on doing my job. I wasn't even registering the bolt noises when they were hitting the turret, or the glass when the glass would spiderweb. None of that was registering in my head. I was just so focused on destroying that machine gun nest and then other positions.
That's incredible. It really reminds me of Paul Ray Smith's story. I mean, very, very similar kind of story. So you were wounded eventually when an RPG hit your vehicle, correct?
Correct.
Well, again, I want to thank you again for being with us today. Specialist David R. Hutchinson, United States Army Reserve, only the fifth reservist to receive the Silver Star. Thank you for your service.
All right. Thank you for having me again.
Profiles in Valor is produced by the American Veterans Center and Radio America. To hear more profiles, subscribe on iTunes or visit www.americanveteranscenter.org.